from North America's oldest campus newspaper, the Dalhousie Gazette, and CKDU 88.1 FM, this is Behind the Story. As members of the Gazette, we're thrilled to be back with a new season of our podcast. We've mixed things up a bit and hope you will enjoy the revised format.
I'm Elizabeth Foster, the Gazette's Arts and Lifestyle Editor.
And I'm Lynn Harrison, the Gazette's News Editor.
On this episode, Lane and I will be interviewing Sierra Sparks, Dalhousie's 92nd Rhodes Scholar.
In the first section of our interview, we'll discuss the process and stress of becoming a Rhodes Scholar. Later, we'll talk about Sierra's outreach work to diversify STEM and discuss her thoughts on the racist Zoom bombing that took place during the chair chat for Black students at Dal, which happened shortly before we recorded our interview. And now, to kick off our interview, meet Sierra Sparks.
Hi, I'm Sierra Sparks. I'm a recent graduate of electrical engineering at Dalhousie University, and I'm really excited to be the 92nd Rhodes Scholar from Dalhousie University. I'm really interested in STEM outreach and advocacy efforts, and I really want to incorporate that into my future work.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to be here.
So something that a lot of people don't know too much about is the actual process of becoming a Rhodes Scholar and how that actually starts within Dal. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so it is definitely a bit of a long process. Essentially they have the Rhodes Scholarships. They distribute them based on the region that you either go to school in or that you live in. So, for me, that's definitely Canada. I'm born and raised in Nova Scotia, and also go to school in Nova Scotia. But within Canada, they have, 6 different regions, and one of them is the Maritime region. And so, being both, you know, a resident and kind of a school resident of the Maritimes, that was the region that I was applying for. And so they have 2 scholarships within the Maritime region. And what you do at the beginning is you have to be put forward by your school to be able to first even apply for the scholarship. So Dalhousie, how they do it is they have an internal deadline. They'll usually do workshops throughout the year, just kind of information workshops to say, ask people if they have questions about the application process. I know last year they did one in March and I think August. So they have them. They might have had more. I'm not sure, but I know for sure they had those 2. So they usually strive to have at least a couple a year just to give people information throughout the process and things like that. But once, you know, whether you attend or not, once they have those, they usually have an internal deadline to submit basically a personal statement, which is 1,000 words, basically explaining why you should be a Rhodes Scholar and why, talking about your story. And that's kind of what I was talking about earlier when I said that really gave me a lot of time for self-reflection. Writing that statement really did, when I was trying to say and really present myself, that was what I was overwhelmingly seeing in just thinking about the things that I like to do and tying them all together. And then you also submit a resume and they review your transcript. And so Dalhousie has an internal selection committee that they'll take from their applications, interview people depending on the strength of the applications. And then once they interview people, then they'll let people know whether they're okay, you can apply for the scholarship, or no, unfortunately, you can't apply for the scholarship. And so they do that, I think, to limit the number of applications and also just to make sure that there's the people who are applying are, I guess, prepared for the process, because it is still a long process, and they want anyone who they're sending to be, I guess, committed to the process. And so once you if you make it past the interview phase, then you submit all of your documents to the Rhodes Trust. And within Canada, you need 6 references. So it definitely is a lot of references. So I was thinking over the summer of who I would ask for the references. You collect them and you need at least 3 academic references, and then the rest can be character or academic references. And so you submit all of that. It's, you know, a lot of work put into tailoring your academic CV or your CV and resume to this scholarship specifically, because, you know, the resume that I used to apply to jobs was very job experience heavy, whereas this one, I talked a lot more about my volunteer experiences and things like that, and my academic experiences. And yeah, so you submit that, and then the Maritime region, they review all of the applications for that region. And again, it's not necessarily from people who go to school in the Maritimes. It could be someone who's from here and goes to school in, say, Ontario. They could choose to apply for the Maritimes instead, and vice versa. Yeah, so then that kind of happens, and then they make their selections and invite people to interviews. And then they have a final interview where, in normal years, and actually we were super lucky because this was like the week before the Atlantic bubble like died. So that was really lucky that we were able to do our interviews in person. And so we had the night before, there's, what they call a social engagement event. So it's basically a really fancy, like, banquet style dinner, with all of the people that are being interviewed as well as the judges. So you get to meet them, talk with them. Obviously, you know, it's part of the assessment process, but they really try to make it, a little bit, you know, more comfortable and really inviting for people to really talk about what they're passionate about and just enjoy, you know, a nice meal. And I mean, especially for me, I was really appreciative of that night because it did make me feel a lot more comfortable, with everyone. And also just, since, you know, with everything that was going on with COVID and everything being shut down, it was really nice to have a somewhat normal dinner. You know, we were spaced 6 feet apart at these gigantic tables, which was kind of funny to see, but, yeah, it was really interesting, to have that conversation and, meet everyone. And then the next day they have the one-on-one interviews, which are usually about, 45 minutes long each. And then they ask you a lot of things, from a variety of topics. Usually they talk about current events. So this year they've had a lot of current events that they could have pulled from. It was, the interviews happened, towards the end of November. So, that was surrounding, you know, the US election, obviously COVID-19, Black Lives Matter, and also the Indigenous, fishers in Nova Scotia. That was also, a topic of discussion that was brought up, and, you know, among other things. But so they ask about current events and kind of ask for your opinions. And I found personally that the interviews were really almost like a conversation. Like, it was really engaging, rather than, you know, just question and answer. It was almost, a back and forth. And that was really cool to see as well. You know, it wasn't, overly too scary because it was like a conversation, and it felt like, you know, they were honestly asking for my opinion rather than trying to, I guess, you know, tear me apart or anything like that. It was really cool, to be kind of in that, interview setting and really think about things that I wouldn't have necessarily thought about, if we weren't kind of having the conversations about them. And, yeah, so then you have the interviews and they schedule them all back to back. And then they're done kind of by late afternoon, and they tell everyone the results, later that evening. So it's the same day that you do the interviews that they phone everyone individually and let them know, the results. So it's I finished my interview around 3 PM, and I got a call, around 5:30. And so it was, you know, from the time I ended the interview and the time I got the call, I really couldn't do anything basically, because I knew I had to be expecting a call either way. They were going to call. And so I was like really cognizant of where my phone was the whole time and making sure that I had it, you know, on ringer. And I was, oh man, I was so jittery that whole evening. And then getting the call, you know, seeing the unknown number, I was like, oh man, this must be them. And yeah, just getting that call, I ran downstairs. I was at my parents' house because I wanted to be with them, you know, either way, whether it was a positive result or a not so positive result. And so, yeah, I ran downstairs and nearly fell over while I was running down the stairs because I was trying to get to them as fast as I could.
Just to clarify, that was with, so it's the one-on-one, it's you and then seven judges?
Yeah, yeah. So I think the number of judges per year might change depending on the year, but it's usually between 6 and 9 judges. And so, yeah, the one-on-one, yeah, I guess it wasn't so one-on-one. It was, you know, it was a little bit intimidating walking into the room and it's just this gigantic table of a panel of judges. But, you know, I tried to crack a few jokes in the interview. I don't know if they landed well, but, you know, just to try and keep myself at ease as well. And, yeah, I mean, it's, like I said, it's really like a conversation with them. And even the dinner beforehand, the dinner itself was like a 3-course meal and we had conversations in between. And the judges would rotate between the tables so that they were able to basically meet with every person who was being interviewed the next day to kind of get like a sense of who they are. And it also gave, you know, the people being interviewed a sense of who the judges were. Things like that. But even after that dinner was done, and all the judges had left, all of the people being interviewed stayed for about an hour later. We were just talking to each other and it was just really, really great to meet them all. You know, connect with them on social media and just also just talk about the process. And again, like, just having someone that you know that went through the whole experience. And it was just really cool. I mean, everyone there is like, they're all fantastic leaders in their own capacities and are all in completely different fields. And it was really just cool to learn from them even in a short period. But yeah, it was super, super memorable. And yeah, I don't think I'll forget that weekend.
And just so with it being in kind of the last days of the Atlantic bubble, and you said people can apply, if they're applying in the Maritimes, doesn't mean they're living in the Maritimes. Was there anyone who had to come in and then self-isolate and then come to the dinner?
Yeah. So there was actually, so essentially how they did it is they said, kind of 2.5, maybe 3 weeks beforehand, they said that they were planning on doing the interviews in person to everyone, regardless of whether they got an interview or not, because we didn't find out if we got an interview until basically just 2 weeks before the interview. And that's just based on, it is quite a tight timeline from the last day that your references are submitted to when they have the interviews. And obviously it is definitely long. If it's long for us to write them, it's long for the panel to review the applications as well. And so they basically wanted to say that just so that people were able to, if they needed to, plan and self-isolate for 14 days. But obviously, you know, even then it would have been a challenge. And so everyone except one person was able to make it in person. But they did say that they would help accommodate if you weren't able to. And it was just... I think honestly, because this person was in med school and they were doing exams outside of the province. And so they weren't able to essentially take 2 weeks off, which is totally understandable. So yeah, like they did have the virtual interview for that person. But it definitely, I feel bad for them not being able to engage in the social event, but I mean, they ended up being the other winner, so I don't feel too bad, but, but yeah, so they did try to like accommodate for the online, component there as well. Yeah. And, but yeah, I know the other regions across Canada and most of the others kind of across the world, because it is a global scholarship. Most of them ended up doing it online. I think the Maritime region was one of the only ones, if not the only one, that did it in person. Obviously still adhering to COVID guidelines and things like that, but But yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of amazing just that it's the only in the world. Like, I mean, it's obvious that in Canada, but it's just amazing to think in the world. It's a testament, I guess, to shout out Dr. Strang.
Yeah, shout out. Actually, the top doctor in PEI is actually a former Rhodes Scholar as well. Fun fact. Oh. So yeah, maritime charm.
And so you applied kind of first through DAL, but then once you got to the actual part of applying with Rhodes and with Oxford, how did DAL help you prepare and go through that process?
Yeah, so there were definitely things that I changed from my initial application to DAL versus my application to the Rhodes Trust. And they were really, the selection committee were really helpful in telling me what I could work on. They're not supposed to give advice on the personal statement. That's supposed to be completely like your own work and things like that. So there wasn't anything on that, but on my resume, they gave me really helpful advice for what to highlight and what would really stand out in terms of the application. Like I said, I ended up kind of by the end of it having a almost completely different resume for applying to the Rhodes Scholarship versus one that I would use to apply to a job. And that's just because obviously applying to a job, there's different values in, I guess, applying to a job versus applying to a leadership and community service based scholarship. And so, yeah, so they helped me with that. I had kind of a one-on-one meeting with the chair of the Dalhousie Selection Committee to go over that. And then once I had already submitted my applications, and then I found out that I got an interview, there were actually three people from DAL that got interviews. And so they worked with all of us individually to meet with past Rhodes Scholar recipients that either went to DAL or were from Nova Scotia that wanted to meet with us to help us prepare. I met with so many people that within the DAL community that were just, you know, super fantastic. I met with a professor in the theater department to work on my public speaking and things like that. I met with, like I said, a lot of past Rhodes Scholars, and we actually had the day before our social engagement event, the three DAL finalists, we met with someone who won it from DAL 7 years ago, and we were just kind of having a de-stress session with him and, you know, asking our final questions and things like that. But yeah, everyone was super, super supportive throughout that application process, and it really put my mind at ease to hear from them about, you know, the application process and specifically what the interviews were like. Yeah, it was... They gave every kind of piece of assistance that they could, and I definitely took everything that I could from their experiences and things like that. So yeah, they were super helpful throughout the whole process.
Last time, I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, but so last time we were talking about how with the process of applying, you kind of get into Rhodes, the scholarship first before you actually get into Oxford. And so you, I guess, weren't sure exactly what exact courses you would be doing, or, but maybe you can just talk about what you'll be researching and if you know more about that.
So I just submitted my graduate application a couple weeks ago. So I'm still, I guess, in the air on what I'll actually be doing, but I'm hoping to, and what I wrote my research proposal in was to apply to a DPhil in engineering science. So they call a PhD a DPhil in England, but they both stand for Doctor of Philosophy. And so I'm hoping to specialize in biomedical engineering, specifically in medical image analysis. So they have a whole group at Oxford dedicated to image analysis. So that would include with ultrasound, MRI, X-ray, CT, things like that. But what I'm really focused on with my research is in the MRI field, specifically with how it can be used to diagnose and hopefully prevent Alzheimer's and dementia. So they have essentially with dementia and Alzheimer's, and actually with a lot of neurological conditions, they have kind of a lot of theories about why they are onset in the first place. So with Alzheimer's and dementia, it's widely thought, but not sure how confirmed it is. It's widely thought that there's kind of two ways that you can get it. It's either through your lifestyle choices. So, you know, that would be physical activity, nutrition, you know, things like that. Or also just through your genetics. So, you know, sometimes it runs in the family, things like that. Or, you know, it might just be your genes and there's nothing necessarily that you can do to prevent it. But the thing with using MRI to really image, I guess, the cognitive function is that MRI is pretty expensive. And obviously these machines are gigantic. Sometimes they take up almost a whole room just for the MRI machine. And so it's not always feasible to be using those to diagnose people for their conditions. So people have been looking for alternatives to make it, I guess, a lot more accessible to people who maybe don't have that equipment, whether that's because it's not in their area or whether they can't afford to pay for it if it's not included in their healthcare and things like that. Once I get there, I'm hoping to really develop a research plan and, you know, move from there. And once I know a little bit more about the facilities and MRI itself, but what I can definitely say for certain is that it'll involve imaging, specifically MRI, and hopefully being able to diagnose dementia and Alzheimer's at an earlier phase in a less expensive way.
That's so cool. Oh my gosh. You know, it's no secret. This has been a stressful year for everyone. And, you know, with COVID and everything. And on top of that, you've gone through this process of becoming a Rhodes Scholar, which I'm sure was rigorous. And you've also managed to stay extremely involved on campus. So I have to ask, how do you deal with that? Like, how do you deal with the stress?
That's actually been something that I have struggled with a little bit in the past, is kind of juggling all of the school and the extracurriculars, and especially, you know, over the past year, applying to this scholarship, and not even just the scholarship, but to other graduate schools, because of course I definitely wasn't expecting to get this scholarship. So I had a lot of schools that I was applying to kind of in the meantime as well. And, you know, it's almost like a full-time job applying to applying to all these programs and, you know, jobs and things like that. And so what really helped me, to kind of, I guess, de-stress and was to just really make sure that I was scheduling in breaks. And that was really counterintuitive to me, because I would always feel almost at the beginning guilty for taking breaks, and for, you know, I could have been working on an application for a university, or I could have been studying for a midterm that's coming up, or I could have been volunteering, you know, extra hours with the Women in Engineering Society. You know, I did have to miss a couple meetings here and there for some commitments. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing that I learned was that it is okay to, you know, take a step back when you need it, because ultimately you're not going to be able to give your best effort and be your best self if you're feeling drained, whether that's physically, emotionally, mentally. And so, you know, once I was able to say to whatever it might have been, whether that was, you know, an organization that I was volunteering with, or even with classes, I had to do this a couple times just to say, hey, you know, I'm really not in a good headspace right now, or, you know, I'm feeling a little bit overwhelmed. Is it possible for me to, you know, do this next week instead? Or, you know, next week is looking a lot more clear for me. Is that possible? And, you know, at first I felt guilty for, you know, taking that time for myself. But at the end of the day, once I was able to take that time, I felt a lot more energized and was able to put in, you know, a lot more effort into these involvements, and it really paid off in the end. Taking breaks and switching it up has been really good for me. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I like doing a lot of different things, is because if I'm feeling, overwhelmed with grad school applications or the Rhodes Scholarship application, I can switch to, okay, well, I'm going to volunteer with the Engineering Society today, because that's completely different, ways of thinking, and I'm able to actually interact with people when I'm doing that and things like that. And sometimes, vice versa, when I'm feeling a little bit drained from seeing people or drained from whatever it may be, I can kind of go back and do things that are a little bit more independent. And so, I've found that having, interests in a lot of different areas has helped me to really cope with a lot of that, stress.
Right. And how has being now being known as a Rhodes Scholar changed your outreach and how that all works?
Yeah. So it has. I've definitely gotten a lot more opportunities to be able to speak and do this outreach work after, being named a Rhodes Scholar, which honestly, I've been really excited about, because it's given me a lot more opportunities to connect with people that I wouldn't have even had the opportunity to connect with beforehand, and really talk about not only kind of my journey to applying to the Rhodes Scholarship and things like that, but just my overall journey and experiences. I really that's what I really enjoy, is that a lot of the time when I'm doing this work, whether I'm reaching out to an individual or an organization to say, hey, I'd like to participate in this workshop or give a talk, or if they're reaching out to me, the expectation isn't always that I'm only going to be talking exclusively about the scholarship or about academics. I'm able to really talk about, what I feel is important and what the audience feels is important as well. And that's been really, really fantastic. I love to talk. I do love to hear other people's perspectives as well. And when I'm, especially a lot of the time, this is with junior high and high school students that I'll be doing workshops with or talking about engineering with, often with either young women or people of color, and talking about how those identities can shape your experiences in STEM, specifically in engineering, from my experiences. And so getting the scholarship just really fueled my passion and energy to be able to put even more energy into these pursuits. And really, now that I'm a Rhodes Scholar, I definitely feel that there's a lot more eyes on what I'm doing. but I find that's a good thing for me. And, it really motivates me to be putting my best foot forward and, to be able to talk and with as many people as I can, to hopefully, impact their lives for the better.
And how has COVID-19 changed that, and also just your involvement on campus in general.
Yeah, so it definitely did change it, like probably a lot of things. And honestly, I think that with this switch to online kind of engagement primarily, it actually gave me a lot more opportunities to do this outreach work, because, it makes it automatically a lot more accessible to people who may not be able to drive all the way to Halifax to participate in a workshop, or who may not be able to, afford to pay sometimes these workshops in different, facilities. Sometimes you're missing school, so you're paying, with your time and things like that. Whereas with the online environment, they're a lot more flexible, and you're able to do a lot more workshops and a lot more discussions with students, kind of no matter where they are. So Over the past year, I've been able to speak virtually with a lot of different high school and junior high school students who weren't always, you know, in the Halifax core. And I've also been able to speak with working professionals from all across Canada, as well as engineering students from all across Canada. And, you know, it's been really, really great in that sense, because yes, you know, within Halifax, it's decently easy to meet up with students and to meet up with professionals and things like that. But when you're looking at, you know, across Atlantic Canada and even across Canada, that becomes a lot more of a logistical challenge. And so I found that with the online, it's become a lot easier to make those connections and to really talk to students and engage with students, kind of no matter where they are. So that location is no longer a barrier, and you're able to reach a lot more students. I've found specifically with my involvement with the Canadian Federation of Engineering Students. So I'm the vice president academic, which mainly focuses on advocating for engineering students in various regards. But of course, this year, the biggest topic was, of course, COVID-19 and remote learning and how that's challenging engineering students specifically across across the country. And so, you know, with this sense, a lot of the times they'll have meetings with deans across Canada, and they'll have to fly to a different city, unless you're, of course, in that city, which would be lucky. But, you know, a lot of the time they will have to fly, and that's obviously not good for the environment. It's not good for the cost of the flights and things like that. And I've been able to talk with deans across Canada, engineering deans specifically, just through my laptop, you know, through Zoom and things like that. And that's been really a really unique experience that I definitely would not have had if things were in, I guess, normal terms. And so having that opportunity to talk directly to deans and advocate for students about pressing issues like, you know, the major concerns about tuition in an online setting, or quality of education and learning experiences with maybe not getting the same lab time and things like that. That's been really, really great to be able to do that virtually. Of course, there, you know, you are missing that in-person connection, and, you know, that's not something that you can, I guess, fully make up when you're online, but it does present definitely some opportunities as well.
You've also helped shape the curriculum at Dal through that inclusive design report. So I was hoping you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I was the treasurer on the IEEE, which stands for Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, the student branch at Dalhousie for that organization. And part of that organization, the goal is, you know, it's obviously engineering related, but it's kind of developing and building technology to benefit humankind is kind of their mission statement. This past summer, we, you know, we were trying to think of ways, especially this was basically around the peak of the Black Lives Matter resurgence over this past year. Especially this was right after the death of George Floyd. And, you know, we were feeling really, you know, unsettled with the things that were happening around us. And we wanted to do something within our organization that could essentially show not only our support for the Black Lives Matter movement, but just, you know, overall injustices that are essentially fueled by a lack of understanding of people and what people represent and what people need to see. And so for us in engineering, engineering is really all about design. And a lot of the time that people are designing things, they're not necessarily incorporating a large view, data set of different people with different viewpoints and different experiences and lived experiences. And so we felt that it was really necessary for future engineers, specifically people at Dalhousie, to be exposed to kind of this responsibility to be able to design, to be able to take into account these different perspectives. So I guess one of the really popular examples of why having diverse perspectives is really important is that women are actually more likely to be fatally injured or severely injured in car crashes and that's than men. And that's particularly due to the fact that when engineers and automakers are testing the safety of their cars, they use crash test dummies that are modeled after typically male bodies. And, you know, it was only about 10 years ago that it was mandated to have, you know, a female based body type that was to be also tested. But the thing is, even when they were using that, they weren't actually modeling it after female proportions. They basically just sized down the male crash test dummy, which obviously is not the same. And so that's obviously a really extreme example of where, you know, it really shouldn't be that difficult to make different, you know, crash test dummies for children, for you know, people of different ages, sizes, genders, you know, pregnant women as well. And so that's kind of one example. Another one is, and this one kind of was popular in the news a few years ago about CV and resume databases and sorting algorithms that unintentionally were favoring male candidates just because of the internal biases that they put into their sorting algorithms that favored typically male qualities and names and things like that. And so we felt that it was really important, you know, people who made those mistakes in industry, and it's not just one-off cases. These are happening all of the time. I'll go to the airport. Like I mentioned, my dad has significantly a darker skin tone than I do, and we'll be at the airport and they're doing the automated passport scanning thing. I know the Toronto airport has it, where basically they try to speed up the process in customs. So they scan your passport and they take your picture from there. And his never works because they can never recognize his face. And obviously that's not a huge safety concern, but it is a very big inconvenience. And it shouldn't be an inconvenience. It should be something that engineers are accounting for. And so we basically wrote this report saying that, you know, these cases specifically, we had a lot of case studies. There was also an issue, within Dalhousie, on the engineering campus specifically. The buildings, we just got new ones in 2018, but the older buildings specifically, lack a lot of, female and gender neutral washrooms. And so, people who don't identify as men have to often go to different floors, different buildings sometimes to even just get to the washroom. And so, that's obviously also a design flaw. And so we felt that it was really important to bring these case studies to light and also give recommendations that, these types of principles and ideas and just people being aware that these exist, we thought that it was really important to incorporate that into our classroom. And so we wrote this report and presented it to the engineering faculty. And we specifically had recommendations because a lot of upper year engineering students actually take an engineering and society course, which typically focuses on, you know, impacts on the environment and impacts on the economy and social aspects like that. But we felt that it was also important to talk about this inclusive design aspect and making sure that, you know, having, because obviously if there were more people who had different lived experiences, they'd be able to immediately, you know, with that passport scan, be like, hey, my passport doesn't work here. Maybe we should change that and things like that. So a lot of, you know, a lot of that is being aware that these are issues, but it's also about having diverse teams in the first place. And so we were able to talk to the faculty about this, and we actually did make that part of the curriculum for that engineering in society course this past fall. And yeah, we're super passionate about, the whole team is super passionate about the report. And it's something that, you know, over the course of my degree, I would say is something that I'm most proud of.
About a week before Elizabeth and I spoke to Sierra, a racist Zoom bombing took place at Dalhousie. The racist attack took place at a virtual gathering for Black students hosted by Omishore Dryden, the James R. Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies at Dal. Uninvited users joined the Zoom call and began shouting anti-Black hate speech. We'll talk about that now.
You're someone who works in creating diversity on campus, and that's something you're interested in. So what was your initial reaction to what happened last week at the chair chat?
So I actually found out about it on Twitter. So I work with Dr. Dryden in the Dalhousie Senate, so I'm really familiar with kind of her advocacy efforts and just, you know, how fantastic of a person she is. So to see that, you know, an event that she was creating essentially to make a safe space for Black students, Black faculty, just to create a safe space for them to discuss issues in academia and just anything, really. It was really unsettling to see that that happened and that people would intentionally, you know, people who weren't invited or who didn't belong to the groups that she had been inviting, really kind of really ruin the mood of the event and say things that were racist and misogynistic and homophobic as well. Was just, I wasn't at the event, but reading about it and hearing her comments and also, you know, hearing from students who were there, it's just really unsettling. And it just goes to show that, you know, having these spaces, making sure that they're protected should be a really top priority, not only for the individuals that are creating them, but for the university at large. It's really important for Black students and the overall Black community to be able to connect. And it's just nice to know that there are people that are in, you know, the same situation as you, and you're able to talk openly about these experiences without having to, I guess, further explain them or, you know, try to justify why you felt hurt by something or why you felt uncomfortable in a situation. They're really just there to really be a community. And I think that's really important.
So to a lot of people, this was extremely shocking. I know for me, it was shocking. Everyone I talked to. Is this shocking to you that this happened?
It was shocking at the beginning, just, you know, seeing the things that people had said and the way that they were expressing themselves extremely negatively in this environment. But, you know, looking at it kind of from a bigger picture standpoint and seeing, you know, it's really not a huge shock just because, you know, racism does exist. And this is just one of the forms that it's, especially, you know, in this online environment, that's how it's almost adapting to pervade in these spaces that we're creating online. And, you know, it's really important for us to be aware in, you know, creating digital spaces as well, you know, regardless of whether you're in person or online, these threats can still occur. And in fact, you know, it almost makes it easier for these exact situations to happen when it's in an online environment. So it was definitely extremely disappointing and really disheartening to see. But I wouldn't say it was overly surprising just because of, you know, the underlying issues that are happening, you know, in not only our school or our province, but just, you know, across the world. We've seen, especially this past year, a lot of racist incidents kind of coming to light. And it hasn't only been this year, but you know, they're being caught a little bit more often now. So I would say that, you know, similarly with this, it's not that it's something new. It's just that, you know, it's being brought to light and people are speaking out about it, which I think is really important. You know, it's not even necessarily, I mean, obviously incidents like this was obviously outright racism and misogyny and very problematic behavior, but oftentimes it kind of starts at a much smaller scale with microaggressions and, you know, just kind of side comments that people don't even necessarily realize how harmful they are. And so I think that, you know, I've definitely seen kind of on the smaller side with just microaggressions and people, you know, in the form of people saying that people from certain groups, specifically underrepresented groups in any given field, are given unfair opportunities because they want to increase their diversity. And that's the only reason why they're doing well in their field, or to, you know, why they're getting scholarships, or why they're in that space to begin with is, you know, it is, you know, things like that are said all of the time, but, you know, I haven't seen to this level in an event, but that's not to say, again, that it hasn't happened.
Have you been thinking at all, kind of about those spaces or seeking them out as you're kind of preparing to go to Oxford and thinking about what that'll look like there?
I've definitely been thinking about, what it'll look like. I mean, anytime that I'm moving to a new place, I mean, I've lived in Nova Scotia my whole life, but I did do a couple internships away. And even when I was considering for those 4-month internships, that was almost always something that I considered was, you know, what is the population demographic like there? And, you know, it's not something that I want to be thinking about all of the time, but it is something that, you know, you do have to be thinking about, just for, you know, having that community and also just honestly feeling safe. You know, I've been to smaller towns in Nova Scotia, and not so much for myself, but my dad, who is, he's a lot darker skin toned than I am. And I've seen him directly in these communities, literally just going to the mall and them telling him that he's in the wrong mall. The mall for Black people is down the road, which I'm like, this was 10 years ago. So it's not anything that was super long ago. But, you know, experiences like that, I obviously don't want to go through. And, you know, most places aren't that bad at all. But it is definitely something that I consider when I'm going to a new place. And so it was the same thing with looking at England and Oxford specifically. And what I was really excited to see is that this year specifically, there's 4 Canadian, of the 11 Rhodes Scholars, 4 of them are Black. And of the American scholars, I think 20 of the 32 are people of color. And so it's really, you know, exciting to see that representation. And in fact, kind of the week that the announcement went out about the incoming class of Rhodes Scholars, the 4 Black Canadian Rhodes Scholars, we made a group chat and we've been kind of chatting ever since, just to get to know each other and, you know, really embrace, you know, I think, again, that community is really important, and especially going to a new country, it's going to be really important to have people who understand, you know, not only the Canadian experience, but the Black Canadian experience. I'm really lucky to have that group of individuals who will be there with me kind of throughout the way.
That's the end of our interview for this episode. Thanks again to Sierra Sparks for joining us, and thank you for listening.
Behind the Story is written and produced by Lane Harrison, Elizabeth Foster, and Suzanne Hartman. Liv Landon is our podcast manager. Our sound editors are Lane Harrison and Jeffrey Howard. Torini Fernando is our advisor. Special thanks to Tim McNeil and Seth Glasgow at CKDU for technical support. Behind the Story is a Dalhousie Gazette production.